Welcome to The Village Lantern, a podcast for families living with hidden challenges such as autism and other neurodiverse conditions, and for anyone else wanting to understand, love and support. Our mission is to build understanding, empathy and love for families living with one or more children who have hidden conditions that make life harder in one way or another. We call this extra zing.
This is something I would say for anyone going through a child with disordered eating. The key thing is to act very quickly, because this type of thinking and behaviour can manifest very, very quickly. And once it takes over the brain and the neural pathways start changing, there is a much harder path to come back for, the more embedded it is over time. So I knew from experience with my sisters that I had to act very, very fast. It wasn't something I could just wait and see, oh, it'll get better, it'll be fine, I should just eat more. I knew that wasn't the case.
In the spirit of reconciliation, Takes a Village acknowledges the traditional custodians of country here on the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri Woiwurrung peoples of the Eastern Kulin Nation, as well as throughout Australia, and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. Well, welcome back.
Hello.
I've just got Belle here today, haven't I? Yep. Shar is trying to catch some Z's. Yeah. As we know, she has ongoing challenges with sleep. But I'm excited to be here. We've got a secret guest. Not secret, but Belle, you're going to introduce. Yes. So this is a topic that is dear to your heart and we know dear to many of our villagers' hearts. Interestingly for me, it hasn't really impacted our experience.
Yet.
It's not something that's we've come across yet.
Sorry, and I shouldn't say.
I've been very aware of it and it absolutely could come across, but for me I don't have a personal experience with it. But without making it sound more mysterious than it is, I'll leave it, Belle, for you. And I may chime in with questions now and then. I'm really genuinely someone who's going to be interested, but I don't have a lot to share personally, but I will, if you'll indulge my questions.
Of course we will, Anne. You're our great host. Thanks for that. So I've had a lot going on in our house the last sort of 6 months or so, and it's been really difficult at times. And I've been really grateful to be able to access a lot of wraparound services and some good friends, including our guests today. And I thought it was a great chance to really dive into eating disorders and disordered eating, because I've learnt so much around how you can support your children and how common it is in the autistic community.
But also how like it is a unique presentation of this challenge, isn't it? So is it fair that maybe some of the techniques that are for managing for neurotypical kids, does it need an overlay of neurodivergent sort of specialisation?
Well, I think they're still learning. I think, I mean, because I think when we think of the term disordered eating, eating disorder, you assume like anorexia or bulimia, but, you know, there's so many other types of disordered eating. There's ARFID, which is really common for autistic people. So, I just wanted to bring in this guest who's Rhiannon, who's a really great friend of mine, and she has a lot of lived experience in this area and also autistic children, so that we could really talk about it and really share that lived experience and help people know where to go, where you access information, what you do. So welcome, Rhiannon.
Thanks, Belle. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's all right.
And Rhiannon, I think you might be a listener of our
villager.
You are a long-time listener.
Yeah.
First time guest.
Yeah. And a villager.
It's so nice. And so obviously you know that we talk about our experiences. If we find information, we share it. We always have disclaimers around being experts. I don't need to tell you that, but just a reminder that we really want to hear your personal experience, what you've learned. And also, if you don't know and you're struggling, that's okay too. A lot of the time we say, oh, we tried this or we think this and it hurts and we're suffering.
Yeah. So I'm definitely not an expert, but I have an awful lot of lived experience. So I hope I can share a bit of that today with you, Belle and Anna.
Oh, well, I've got my first question, which is what makes you a villager?
Long time villager. two kids with autism, ADHD,
One diagnosed at 8 and the other at 12. So both.
And how old are they now?
They're now 12 and 15, nearly 16 and 13.
Yeah.
Both are girls, yep. Identify as girls. And yeah, it's been quite the journey.
Yeah. And I suppose when I first met you, which was a very long time ago, I remember that your younger sister was very ill. So maybe that's a bit of a kickoff of the conversation. You could just share the experience as a big sister to someone with both sisters with eating disorders and maybe share that story first.
Yeah, I think that really shapes a lot of my lived experience and subsequent sort of dealing with my own children. I had two sisters, one's 2 years younger than me, one is 8 years younger than me. The one you were talking about, my mm-hmm. younger sister, she was diagnosed with anorexia when she was about, say, 12.
She was 12.
Yeah.
I remember.
Good memory. Yeah. and that was off the back of my other sister who had anorexia when she was in year 9, so 15.
Mm.
So there was sort of a gap of a couple of years, but I think when I met you and my sister was really in the throes of a pretty chronic eating disorder.
Yeah.
Where she was hospitalised, there was a tube down her nose. It was really quite traumatic.
Yeah.
It was traumatic for the family. It was traumatic for her.
Yeah. And so when I met your sister and when she was, your younger sister was going through that, there was very much a treatment around eating disorders as opposed to sort of looking at the bigger picture. Was there neurodiversity there? What was her mental health like? Yeah, so just curious to know how your sister's doing now and tell me more about that kind of journey for her over the last decade or so.
I think she was so young when she was diagnosed with an eating disorder, and there was probably a lot of trauma that we didn't know as a family at the time that was underpinning a lot of that.
Mm.
And I won't go into that
yeah.
because it's personal to yeah. her and her experience. But I think a big part of her treatment was around sort of punitive measures. There was a lot of, you can do this if you gain this weight, you can leave hospital if you have the opportunity to, you know, gain weight in a way that is appropriate to the dictates of the hospital.
And if you don't, you're in trouble.
Yeah, it was a really harsh, almost Victorian approach to mental illness. And I think it wasn't.
But was it even seen as mental illness back then?
No.
I feel like it wasn't. And so I'm just wondering now, has she had a lot of therapy and had a lot of support, and you realise that underlying things were trauma and maybe there was other reasons?
Yeah, certainly. I think there was, you know, as I say, there was trauma that underpinned a lot of it, but also, you know, she's a different type of person. She is different to me. She's different to my other sister.
Mm.
Neither of them necessarily identify as neurodiverse at this stage. But, you know, there wasn't a lot of understanding around difference.
Yeah.
I suppose everyone was, you fit into this category of having anorexia, therefore we treat you this way.
Yeah. That's what I was getting at. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that really has changed over the years.
Talk to me about that, like with your more lived experience, listeners.
So much lived experience.
So you've got a comparison, which is your eldest child, unfortunately, but do you want to talk through that and maybe how the treatment options for her and how, you know, you as parents supported her?
I think I was always hyper aware of what an eating disorder looked like and how easily it could start in more vulnerable children.
Yeah.
That was always at the back of my mind. And when the kids were both diagnosed, that sort of became more front and centre for me.
Diagnosed as autistic.
Yeah, both diagnosed as autistic. I was much more aware of their vulnerabilities and the fact that that was something that potentially could, you know, rear its head at some point.
Yeah.
And I think it took me by surprise when the eldest one was diagnosed with disordered eating last year.
Yeah, yeah.
The year before.
2022.
I know. And I think for me it was a profound shock.
Mm.
And I went into sort of hyper mode of, I've got to fix this.
Yeah.
So I threw myself into it.
Yeah. And what does that look like? When you say, you know, you needed to fix it, how did you support her? And do you look back and think, I absolutely did everything that I could and I'm so happy with that? Or are there things that you might, or ways that you might approach it differently now?
I think, and this is something I would say for anyone going through a child with disordered eating, the key thing is to
act very quickly.
Yeah.
Because this type of thinking and behaviour can manifest very, very quickly. Yeah. And once it takes over the brain and the neural pathways start changing, there is a much harder path to come back for, the more embedded it is over time. Yeah. So I knew from experience with my sisters that I had to act very, very fast.
Yeah.
Wasn't something I could just wait and see, oh, it'll get better, it'll be fine, I should just eat more. I knew that wasn't the case.
And I just read recently, sorry to interrupt you, that a lot of the behaviours that they thought were eating disorder behaviours, I suppose, the manipulation and the all this kind of thing, is actually now malnutrition. So it's that crazy paranoid, all of those things that kind of are quite common. Yeah. Like that is the malnutrition.
Absolutely.
And you get that person back up to having enough calories, potentially they're going to stop all of those behaviours if you can keep their weight at a certain level.
So yeah, and I think that's what underpinned a lot of what I was thinking was that I knew that once the brain starts to become starved of nutrients and what it needs, it goes on a very different tangent and it's very hard to get it back from that tangent once it starts that process of thinking, and you're absolutely right. So,
and you saw that with your sister, so you were like, I'm not letting this happen with my eldest.
Yeah, and because at that time, many, many years ago, they would let them get to a point where they collapsed before they would be admitted in hospital or really taken seriously.
Yeah.
And so I'd watch my sisters get to a point where they had to be hospitalised, and that was so traumatic as a sister.
Awful.
It was really horrific. Mm. And I think that trauma really underpinned a lot of my response.
Yeah. And your response, this is the nugget, this is the gold that I want to get into in this conversation. First of all, though, to acknowledge that that is really horrible that you had to go through that so many times, and also the sort of genetic component, I suppose, to mental illness and eating disorders and everything, was that your daughter, I think maybe because of her neurodivergency, ended up talking to you about, like, she was quite, like, how was that relationship when you sort of discovered what was going on? How were you able to navigate that knowing that she was autistic? What made it different than maybe with your sisters or whatever?
I think I already had a really strong support network of providers around her.
Mm.
So I had a psychologist who she had a working relationship with. We still do have the same people in who support her, amazing pediatrician.
Yeah.
And we went on to have a dietitian who specialised particularly with working with girls who were neurodivergent.
Yeah.
And what happened was my daughter actually confessed to her psychologist, I think there's something a bit wrong with my eating.
Mm.
And so the psychologist did an assessment of her with the official eating disorder.
Yeah, the plan. Yeah.
And she invited me in. We had a chat and she said, I think your daughter has some disordered eating.
Yeah.
And it's really important to distinguish between disordered eating and full-blown anorexia.
Yeah, I know, because people assume with disordered eating you have to look a certain way, but no.
It's actually,
particularly with autistic people.
Yeah.
I think that's the message I want to get across.
It's a disordered thinking.
Yeah.
Really around food.
Yeah.
And for us,
intrusive thoughts around food. Yep.
Yeah. And that 100%. Is something that I learnt. I actually didn't know there was something called disordered eating.
Mm.
It's sort of like the step before a full-blown eating disorder. So we were really lucky that we caught it really early. And so I quickly swung into action, found myself a dietitian that I knew my daughter could see pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And we then went into the management of an eating disorder, which is you see a GP every week for a weigh-in. It's very sort of black and white. You turn up, they get weighed, they're not allowed to see
what their weight is.
That's really important because they often fixate on the figures.
Yeah.
And then we went to the dietitian and just very gently, and so much credit to her.
Mm. Dietitians are amazing.
Oh, she was such a gift. And she helped our daughter to really reframe her focus around food.
Yeah.
And what food looked like for her.
Yeah.
And how it tasted, how it felt in her mouth, what was appropriate to be eating. Because I think there's a real disconnect between what they think they need and what they actually need.
Yeah.
And that probably never
Because you can end up just eating junk.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like as in where you're thinking, okay, well, I need to get the calories in, I'm just going to eat that. But that's not going to be good for your mental health either.
No, no. And it's about the proper nutrients that actually feed your brain in a way that is healthy to you.
Yeah. And I think that's what I had no idea about, that kind of three-pronged approach until you talked to me about it. And I think that's the thing that I wanted to really share and with you today was everything that I've learned over the last 6 months with, you know, autism and disordered eating and what's going on in my house is that if getting onto things really quickly and not letting them get to that stage, like with your sisters, which is no one's fault, but definitely what the thinking was back in the 90s, and having that support crew around you all is so critical, and things have changed so much. And I think that your eldest is so lucky that she had you there and that you knew what to do and that you were tapped into all of that, because people just, I think there's still a thinking that you have to look a certain way.
To be very, very sick.
To be very sick. Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose the summary of what you did, because I think it's really helpful, is the GP or a paediatrician, they look after that medical side of things. So they are doing that weigh-in, they're checking the blood pressure, they're checking vital signs, all of those kind of things. And it's very like arm's length, ticking boxes, you know, and not necessarily disclosing to the patient where their weight is. Is that correct? Yeah.
That's right. And I think when you've got a child under 18, as a parent, you need to be there.
You need to be there.
Every
yeah.
appointment,
yeah.
every step of the way.
Yeah.
And as a result, I ended up not working for a period last year because I knew I needed to be able to support my daughter. Because then that ended up looking like I went up to school when she had lunch so that she'd come into the car and eat lunch.
Yep.
So I made sure she ate what she needed to eat.
Yeah.
It involved.
And who told you to do that?
The dietitian.
Yeah. Yeah.
So and that's the psychologist.
That's the second approach. So the dietitian, tell me what the dietitian does. So they said, this is what you need to do, Rhiannon.
Yes.
Can I just ask a question before that? Because I'm interested in the start, you take yourself to a medical, like to a GP to start it. Does it ever happen, and I don't know if this happened to you or for other people, that they don't take it as seriously as you might be? Can you have that problem where they're like, oh, look, I think it's fine, or do you need to advocate?
I think if they're not an experienced GP or they're older, that could happen.
I guess I'm wondering for people listening who might find that they have tried to raise it with, say, a doctor, does it ever happen that they say, oh, you're over-worrying? You know, sometimes mothers or parents can get a bit like told that they're worrying too much about something.
I think if a parent was worried, the first thing I would do is go and see my GP.
And if you didn't get the response from the GP, would you go to a different one?
Absolutely.
Go to a different one, 100%. Wouldn't you? Like if you just, I think listening to your gut as a parent in this life is so important. And we know, and I mean, I raise it because we've got so much stress in our lives and we're worrying about so much. I certainly do this sometimes. I think, am I worrying? Am I being a bit too over the top here?
It's
but
a good
I think
question.
It's really important that we trust our guts. And if we're not getting the response from the professional that we think we want, then we find someone else, right?
Yeah. And so just to add into that as well is we went to the GP and they put us on a health care plan. So different to the mental health plan.
Yeah, when you have like more than
the
one
eating disorder plan.
Sort of service that you need.
And so that enabled accessing dietitian to look at kind of positive things, whatever. But they didn't ask questions around other things at that point.
Mm.
But when I went to the pediatrician was like, oh, no, this is the process. We get onto this straight away and full filling out forms and doing this kind of thing. Because I think pediatricians know autism plus disordered eating, not a good thing.
Yes.
So, and I do think pediatricians, you spend longer in those appointments.
Yeah.
You have more access to time with them and they build up a really vital body of knowledge, and that's why your relationship with your pediatrician is actually vital.
Yeah.
Especially because pediatricians are specialists as well in some sight, aren't they?
Yes.
So a developmental pediatrician, and as I'm saying this, I know that it's really hard to find them and it's really hard to get in, but that specialisation where they will have particular knowledge around autism and other developmental disorders, because it's becoming so clear to me in every aspect of the services that we engage with our children, be it school or doctors or anything, when you have autism-informed people, it's a world apart in terms of understanding how the presentation might be coming, what might be behind it, and how to lean into it in a way that might be helpful, knowing that all autistic people are
doing it. We were very lucky because the pediatrician that we were already seeing for our eldest daughter happened to be a specialist in eating disorders.
Mm. And developmental as well, or more leaning that way?
More eating disorders. Right. Actually ran one of the big runs one of the big hospital eating disorder units. So, and I didn't know this before we ended up.
We call them God moments.
Yeah.
It was, isn't it?
You know, insert your own higher power here, but God moments where thank you universe for allowing this to be the situation.
And I think a lot of that was underpinned by knowledge of obviously my lived experience with my sisters, but also my mother. So my mum is a retired nurse now, but when we were going through this with my sisters, my mum fought so hard for them and was able to really advocate on their behalf with no knowledge around eating disorders in the 90s.
Just like her there mama was gut.
None.
Just her mama gut though, right?
Yeah, and she pushed and she pushed and she pushed. Yeah. And that example to me has been vital, has underpinned everything, because I know now medical professionals don't know everything.
Particularly
when there's overlapping, like co-occurring things.
Absolutely. Yeah. We as parents know far more about our children than any medical specialist is ever going to be. So it is, like, to your point, Anna, it is so important to listen to your gut.
And also, though, I think there is also a real opportunity, and I acknowledge that the three of us sitting around this table and most of the people that we talk about stuff like this with are fierce, where we have the privilege of education, the privilege of confidence to push back on the system.
Yeah.
And not everyone is given that gift, but even just the mindset of knowing that, and I think generationally there's a thing there too, so even more impressive of your mum, the mindset of saying, pushing against that computer says X or Y, you know, like generationally and culturally and socioeconomically, there's different ways that we respond to experts, and sometimes we think you're the doctor, you know. And they do, but also so do we.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we said at the beginning we're not experts, but we are, you know, taxpaying citizens that we have our rights to challenge the system. And if we don't think that they're seeing what we're seeing or they're not taking it as seriously, push back, but also go somewhere else. If you can't, you know what I mean?
Yeah, go somewhere else. If your GP is not giving you the answers you want and instinctively you know deep down something is not right, keep pushing it, another opinion, and regardless, keep going until you get the answers you want.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it's also, last time Belle and I had a conversation about Ross Green. I don't know if you listened to that one, but that approach of rather than addressing the behaviour, right, which in this case it's the behaviour is, you know, avoiding food or not taking in enough, to get to the underneath why. And we've learned that through our neurodiverse kids, but that's the same for everyone, right, everywhere. Mm. And even if you find experts who maybe don't understand autism, but they understand this concept of the underlying stuff behind, that's good enough. Like if you can't find an autism expert, at least finding someone who's on your side with the let's really get to underneath this. Let's find out what are those causes and triggers and things getting in the way rather than just, as your mum had to deal with, dealing with that high level, just the behaviour, right?
And I think, you know, your mum's incredible, but I'm just thinking back in the 90s, they didn't think about the underlying. No. It was like, this person is not eating, they're starving themselves.
Ross Green did.
Yeah.
God love him. He started in the 90s, but he's still a minority, right, in the voices.
But now it's like, okay, if you've got disordered eating or you're not eating or you're bulimic or whatever it is, there's a reason why. Is it because you think you're different, there's been an episode, trauma, blah, 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 whatever. That would be the first thing that's kind of asked. And that's what I think the paediatrician asks is like, okay, I'm not going to question what the parent is saying here, that something's not right, but I'm going to question potentially the teenager and say, what's going on? What's going on in your life? Let's try and get to a moment where maybe
that's
something.
That's so interesting as well, Belle, and it sounds like this is a teenage challenge mostly. Is that fair to say? Mostly. I know that it can start earlier.
Or tween,
generally tween. And one of the things that is a new world for me is managing a teenager with pretty severe neurodivergent impediments or things that are getting in the way. And what that means for me sometimes is I see them as more childish or younger and I'm not seeing them as a teenager, but acknowledging that they want to talk to someone else other than mum about stuff. And so, you know,
Leave the room. Do you leave the room? I have to leave the
room. Oh, I'm not in the room.
So that's maybe for other people who are used to being, especially if you've been alongside your child with lots of challenges and you've been sitting there in the room advocating for them and all of a sudden you need to leave. Mm. That's such a big shift.
Yeah.
And it can be a bit painful for the mum or the parent, but it's so important to understand that part of sometimes this is that they can't talk to someone else, and, mm. and having that access to services and experts who are going to encourage them to do that.
Yeah.
But without us.
Without us.
But it's so big.
Without us, but well, the other thing I want to talk about is a new type of therapy, which Rhiannon did. It's called family-based therapy. So it's not family therapy. It's family-based therapy for eating disorders.
Oh, my God, let's talk about it. Tell me everything.
So it is like basically it's the complete opposite to probably what Rhiannon's sisters had to experience. So it's where the evidence says, and it's really controversial, but the evidence says in Australia that the child or teenager with the eating disorder is better off being in the home environment. And that means that there has to be a carer or a parent that is there. The child is not left alone. And if you're at school, you are driving to school like Rhiannon did, and you are making sure the calories are coming in. Your dietitian is ensuring that you're not exercising. You're not, you know, all of that calorie intake has to match the exercise. So it's like if you are exercising more, you need to have more calories, and it's all measured. But the parent, like what Rhiannon had to do, has to be there all the time.
What if they're railing against their parents?
Can you they do.
They do, right?
They do, particularly at the beginning.
It's brutal.
There is a real period at the beginning where there is a lot of pushback from the child, and it is so painful. It is so hard as a parent to be that really strong sort of tree that they're pushing up against.
And because aren't they saying things, and I'm getting this from one of my kids, I am however old I am, I have my rights. Like I you know, they're starting to understand that they do have some rights as an individual separate to being.
But there's a whole way that you deal with an eating disorder. Like you give it a name, like Johnny or
whatever. Really? Like a person name?
Yeah. And so you're like, this is Johnny wanting to come into this table here.
Right.
And you kind of, you are very arm's length. You say this, you know, this Johnny is not welcome with us at the table. You know, it's time to focus on this. You have to provide all this scaffolding. So, Rhiannon, do you want to talk a bit about that scaffolding, how you
do that as a parent? That was a really important part of how we dealt with it with our daughter. It was very much guided by the paediatrician saying, we actually collectively, all the therapists around our daughter said, this is a time when we just need to step in and give you some extra support.
Mm.
So we're just going to take some of the things off the table to enable you to just, you know, not have to deal with so much because their brains aren't working properly. Yeah.
So what was taken off the table, like extracurricular? So
extracurricular, we pulled a lot of that back.
They're often not allowed to do exercise.
I think there's you've got to weigh up what is good for their mental health as well. Being involved in a group sport is really important. Mm. You know, moving their bodies is actually really important.
Not if they're underweight though.
But not that's where you really do need to be guided by the professionals around you. But we were very much able to come in and say, this is what your body needs.
Yeah.
It's not about size or anything like that. It's this is what your body needs to be able to function in a way that's healthy. And so, well, even not healthy, I mean, that's a word in itself.
Yeah, healthy is loaded, so loaded, isn't it?
Yeah.
Strong.
Yeah, and it's finding other words that don't really talk about body shape or anything to do with that. So we were given a sort of a meal, rough meal plan. We knew she needed to have three main meals of breakfast, lunch and dinner, and then she needed snacks in between those, so morning tea, afternoon tea and an evening snack. And we just said to her, this is what you need to have. So around mealtime we would sit at a table and there would be obviously a discussion, there'd be pushback, but the whole idea was that we were able to calmly respond and say, this is just what you need to eat. You can take as long as you want, but you will have to eat what's on your plate.
Yeah, and I think some tips around that would be really great. I've got a few tips, but if you can remember some things as I'm talking, but I know that distraction is really important. So for some kids, maybe it's them listening to music so they're not thinking about the actual food going in or playing a game.
Yeah, it's really rethinking, you know, a traditional way of eating a meal.
Yeah, yeah. And but you can't leave the table until there's been enough calories have gone in, like facts.
Yeah, but you also don't need to sit at a table.
Yeah, true.
If that's not working for your family.
Of course, we're talking about autistic people here.
Yeah.
No, and lying down, you're not allowed to sit up until, you know.
If you need to sit at the kitchen bench and watch a YouTube video at the same time or read a book or whatever it is that works for your family, do it.
Oh, and shared food was the other tip that we got. Rather than going, this is your food and slap down in front of you, it's that you can select from a range of things and you've got a bit of given control
options.
Over it.
Yeah, and that you've got option A or you've got option B, but it's entirely up to you which one, but you do need to pick one.
Yeah, and it's sort of boring making it like once they picked it, it's like we're not leaving the table until or the floor or the bench or
wherever it may be. Yeah. But I think it's taking the emotion out of it. Mm. And I think for mothers particularly, that can be really, really challenging because it is a really emotional issue.
Yeah.
You're trying to nurture your child and you'd want to be able to feed them. It's a really natural thing to want to do. So,
and you kind of want to scream in their face.
Oh, totally, totally. The number of times. Food. Just eat.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, I knew that wasn't going to help.
Yeah. Because of your lived experience, a lot of people who haven't been through what you've been through would be screaming in their faces, but you were probably like, well, I know where this goes.
Yeah. And I knew that it would just have to be something we would just have to, we're in for the long haul.
Yeah.
And I think that's what parents often don't realise is how long this can go for.
Yeah, so long. Because the other thing that I've learned as well is once their weight starts changing, and no, it's not always about weight, but once the weight starts changing, things Johnny can rear his or her head in a vengeance way because you're like, oh, hang on a second. This is actually like from a parent's perspective, it's working. From the eating disorder person's perspective, oh, shit, this is changing and I don't like this and I'm then going backwards. So it's the
Yeah, it's a bit like two steps forward, three steps back.
Yeah.
And that can repeat over and over again. And as a parent, that can be really, really distressing to watch.
Yeah.
But I think the main thing is to be able to sort of take a longer view.
Yeah.
Even though at the time it feels so horrific and so hard to know that there will be the steps forward and the steps back.
Mm. So when you've got those three kind of clinicians around you, so you've got your psychologist who's addressing the, you know, the intrusive thoughts and trying to change behaviour around eating and feelings and things like that. Then you've got the dietitian who's just, you know, amazing godlike figure who is giving the diet plan and is helping them think about textures and food and picking things that they want to eat. And then you've got the pediatrician looking after the health. You as a parent feel quite supported. There's a lot of appointments, but you probably feel like, okay, we're in good hands here.
Yeah. And I think the key thing at that point was someone for me.
Yeah.
As a parent, I had a really good psychologist and that for me was like putting my own life jacket on.
Mm.
I knew that if I wasn't feeling strong and I wasn't feeling supported in my own mental health, that we were going to be starting from a really bad place.
Yeah.
So partly that's why I stopped working because I knew there was a finite amount that I could deal with.
Yeah.
And if I was able to really focus on my child, and that can be really, really hard because your whole life becomes about your child.
Yeah.
But with the perspective of a psychologist, I was able to really explore some of my own thinking around that and just have the support that I needed that was safe.
Yeah.
No one was going to judge me as a parent. They were just there for me. And that's the one thing I would say for parents out there going through this is make sure you put your life jacket on first.
Yeah. Yeah. We were talking about that in another episode as well, just saying that as hard as it is, particularly for Shah at the moment, that any of those moments that you have where you can actually look after yourself are so important when you're going through a really difficult time with the kids.
Yeah.
And it's hard because when people say that to you when you're in the shit, you're like, I don't even have time to do anything. How would I want to go for a walk?
Yeah, I remember at one point I think I said to you, it was like, I just can't even talk about this.
Yeah.
But I knew, and I knew I had friends there that when it came to it, I knew I could rely on.
Yeah.
And I knew just got it.
Yeah.
And I think finding those people in your life is so, I'm going to get quite emotional, is so valuable and essential. Like you can't get through this stuff without people around you to support you who understand how hard this is.
You taught me so much. I think this is why I wanted to do this episode because, like, you know, for all of us parents out there, like you don't know until you're in that situation. And I think that getting, you know, learning, hearing from you saying it's important to get onto things early and they don't have to look a certain way, but if they're, you know, if there's a cry for help here, you go to the dietitian, you do all these kind of things and you make sure that you're also in a good place to be able to go through this whole exhausting, time-consuming process with your child is like critical because a lot of people do wait. They think, oh, hang on, my child's been doing this for 6 months and I'm noticing they're fussy with their food, or they're waking up in the night exercising, or they're doing whatever strange behaviours that are part of that disordered eating, that you don't really know where to go and what to do. And there's a whole process, and there's a plan, and there's like a eating disorder plan as well, which I think I would like to say for other people out there. Rhiannon had to quit her job, but I have another friend who she was able to take, because they went on this plan through the Children's Hospital, this family-based therapy plan, that she was able to take carer's leave for an extended period of time, because she was like, well, this is what I've been presented with from the Children's Hospital. We're doing family-based therapy. That means that it's all happening in the home, and it means that I have, you know, 3 appointments a week with the, you know, one with the dietitian, one with the therapist, and one with the doctor. Mm. And I have to drive my child to school. They're not allowed to walk because of the calorie intake, all these things. And I need to take carer's leave.
How long is that?
She took it for 3 months, and then her ex-partner, the dad, took it for another 3 months, but it's been a year now. And her child's doing really well. She said, I just want to be like a normal year 10 now.
Oh, the child said that?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Like, you know, like I want to like go to camp and do.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's been a year of like very.
And I think that's the other thing. Involve the school if you can as well, and you feel comfortable. Yeah. Because the school, a lot of schools.
Well, she wasn't allowed to do sport.
Well, and that's the thing. A lot of schools they've got a lot of experience in this, a lot more than you think.
Yeah.
And there's a lot going on at schools at the moment. The things that teachers and the well-being people at school have to deal with is phenomenal.
Yeah.
But
nothing
they
to do
were
with
really
our children.
No.
Joking.
But they were very much the kids' school, my daughter's school was very much like, what can we do to support you?
Yeah.
So they pulled back a lot of things. For example, not doing a language, you know, really reducing her workload at school. So she was doing the bare amount of homework.
Yeah.
And really at year 7, 8, and 9, that's not a big deal.
Yeah.
Like it's not going to be the end of the world if you don't complete that assignment.
But that approach applies for all the different reasons that you might be having a rough time at the time, you know. I think the approach that you would have taken for any other thing that's consuming, it's the same thing. And it's the schools will have experience, if not in that instance, and if they can't sort of get their head around it, then you say, well, what do you do when a child has something else? Like what if a child's just lost a parent, or, you know, what are the other things that to help them connect the types of accommodations that they can make?
Yeah, because often you don't know if you don't ask.
Yeah.
Mm. And if you're not upfront with the school, as hard as that can be, and you're not an advocate for your child, you have to be an advocate for your child. Mm. And that was the other part of the puzzle for us, was I became an advocate.
Mm.
And that's really underpinned a lot of, you know, how I've moved forward with this.
Yeah. Oh, you did such a good job Like, thank you so much for coming in and sharing that. I think it's really going to help a lot of people that, you know, maybe have started to notice different behaviours with their children.
It's so scary. And it's so, I mean, it's scary, it just is, but to know that people like you have trod that path, that you, and I'm sure there are plenty, I guess that's the other thing, is reach out to other people that you may know around you who might be going through something similar, because from a local perspective, being able to know a good local GP or a good local specialist, that being able to ask around and find people who are a little bit ahead in that journey is so helpful.
I've referred the dietitian to quite a lot of people.
Amazing. Because once you find someone who is really good and really understands, or at least is really open, that's actually really important. Then,
and I think even starting with a dietitian, if you've got some concerns that aren't necessarily medical yet, but you're like, you know, because they might have ARFID, like, you know, behaviour, textural, sensory, dietitians are amazing with all of that. You know, trying to come up with a bit of a plan that's going to suit your family, and then you see where things go, because nipping it in the bud is early is really important.
That's my number one message.
Yeah.
Nip it in the bud.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And just a little side note, she's doing really well.
Oh, good.
She's doing really well. She's in year 10 and thriving.
Yeah.
Thriving. And look, we still have ups and downs. When the anxiety presents itself, I see little hints of it coming back again, but I'm able to, you know, really approach it with love and care for what her well-being is at the end of the day, and, you know, just give her a big hug.
Oh, what a lucky girl she is.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, really amazing. Thank you.
Such a pleasure. I would love to have you again sometime.
Anytime.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye. Bye.